Hello and welcome back to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Tricarci. There are two parts to every M&A deal. There's the exciting part, the strategy, the negotiation, and the thrill of getting the deal signed. That's what we covered last time. And then there's what comes next, when the ink is dry and the SEC clock starts ticking. You've got 4 business days to file that initial 8K. And then the countdown begins to pull together the targets, financial statements, and pro forma information before your 71-day grace period runs out. That's what we're diving into on today's episode. My guest is KPMG partner and former SEC Associate Chief Accountant, Melissa Rocha. During her time at the SEC, Melissa handled many of the most complex questions about business combination reporting. So she's going to take us inside that world of 8Ks, significance tests, 305s, and all the other SEC rules that she can think of that trip up even the most seasoned deal makers. Plus, perhaps most importantly of all, Melissa is going to share some practical tips for navigating the all-important SEC waiver process. And yes, this entire conversation is eligible for a full CPE credit. You can claim it for free by visiting our website. I'll put a link in the episode description. Once you're there, just click the link for this episode and it'll take you to our CPE platform. Now, here's my conversation with Melissa. Melissa Rocha, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we just did a podcast with Dean Bell and Carol Stryker about the state of the M&A market, what they're seeing, what they are forecasting for 2026. And I'll just say there's a lot of encouraging signs that activity is picking up. I know we've gotten a lot of requests for diligence in the last few weeks. There's a lot of sellers that have this parking lot full of assets, that Carol put it, and just a lot of cautious optimism that we're going to see a real uptick in M&A activity in the year ahead, which is very exciting. But with that comes the SEC reporting requirements. And I wanted to bring you in here because I know this was your bread and butter while you were at the staff.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about, you know, what those companies who are going to be doing deals need to think about when it comes to the filing requirements. And so I'm going to let the audience in on a little secret about you. You love to cite the regulations. So I'm going to give you an opportunity here. The floor is yours. Please tell us, when you acquire another company, what are those SEC rules that you need to think about?
That's really funny. Yes, I do like to speak in code and use my numbers. So yes, there are a couple things to think about. First being item 101 of Form 8K, that requires you to announce when you're going to enter into a material definitive agreement. And that 8K is usually required to be filed within 4 business days. So the company may be required to file an 8K as soon as the merger or acquisition agreement is entered into, even if it won't close for a while, actually. Then there's also the 201 8K, and that's triggered upon consummation of a significant acquisition or disposition. And this 8K also must be filed within 4 business days after consummating the transaction. And it also requires some disclosures, such as the date of completion of the acquisition, a description of the assets acquired, the nature and amount of consideration, and the source of funds, just to name a few. Okay, and then there's another, and I also want to point out 201, there's another number. 201 refers you to item 901 of 8K, where the financial statements of a significant acquisition are required to be filed. And those financials of the target are referred to as 305 financial statements.
101, 201, 901, 305.
Yes, okay, 305, as that is the rule in SX that governs financial statements of acquirees. So the focus—
And that's the big one.
That's the big one. Yeah. The focus in that one is the term significant. So when it's significant acquisition, financials would be required. And then finally, if the financial statements of the acquiree are required to be provided, this is done by amending the initial 8K. So the one that included all the 201 information that was filed within 4 days, the financial statements would be filed in an amendment to that, and you get an extra 71 days to get that done. But I'm not done yet.
You're not done yet.
Okay. So 901 of 8K also requires Article 11 of SX, pro forma financial information. And that just shows the impact of the acquisition. And typically the pro formas go hand in hand with 305. So I know it's a lot of numbers.
Did that feel good?
It did.
So let me try to just recap this. You enter into a merger agreement, material mm-hmm. definitive, 4 business days. You've got to announce that, yep. file an 8K. Then once it closes, you have 4 days to file the next 8K.
Correct.
And there's some specific things that go in that document. Then you get another 71 days to include the financial statements of the target, but only if it's significant.
Correct.
Right? And then you might have to put some pro formas in too to show correct. The impact of the transaction. So let's switch from numbers to words. And I want to hone in on that word significance, mm-hmm. because that's really the key word that's going to trigger, you know, those 8K filing requirements and those 305 financial statements, which again are the historical financial statements of the target. And not only that, it's going to determine how many years of those financial statements need to be included. So let's start there. What is significance? How is that determined?
So it is a big math exercise, and in Rule 102W of SX, you will find
you can't
those,
help yourself.
I can't. You will find those significance tests. So there's actually an investment test, an asset test, and an income test, and it basically compares the size of the acquisition to the size of your company.
Okay, so 3 different tests. I don't want to get into the complex math exercise, but give us the back of the napkin version of each one of those.
Sure. So there's definitely nuances to each of these tests. So I'm going to keep it very high level and simple. The investment test is essentially asking how big the price tag was of the acquisition compared to the acquirer's overall size. The asset test compares total assets of the acquired business to the total assets of the acquiring company. And the income test looks at the target's income or loss compared to the acquirer's. So if you do have to do any of these calculations, like I said, there are some nuances. But CorpFin actually just released a new version of their FRM that actually was updated for these new rules. Okay. And so there's a lot of information in there about different nuances to different tests.
Perfect. And I'll give a plug for our own publication. We have a handbook, yep. SEC considerations for business combinations, whole slew of Q&As on all those nuances that go with each of these tests. I mean, you made it sound so easy. But I guess if I'm following you, you're basically going to come up with some kind of percentage for each test, right? Yep. Whether it's assets to assets, income to income, whatever test we're looking at. So then you pick the highest percentage, you compare it to a threshold. Take us from there.
Okay. So the thresholds are like buckets. You take the highest percentage and compare it to these 3 buckets. So okay. The first threshold is 20%. So if the tests are below 20%, then generally you're not going to have to file 305s. But of course, there's exceptions to that, which I'm sure you're going to ask about.
I will.
If it's above 20% but less than 40%, you need to file 1 year of targeted audit financial statements and any required interims. And then if it exceeds 40%, that bumps you up to 2 years of audited financial statements and interims, but also the comparatives.
Okay. So I used to watch, I still do, pardon the interruption. They would play this game, little deal, big deal, okay. No deal. That's kind of what this
yeah,
is, right?
It is.
No
uh-huh.
deal if yep. you're less than 20%. You're not going to file anything.
Yeah.
Little deal if you're between 20 and 40 and you got to include that 1 year. And then if you're over 40, the requirements ratchet up from there.
You like your analogies.
I do love my analogies.
I like my numbers.
I have a podcast called By Analogy. So you know me well. But this brings us to the real reason I wanted to have you on, which okay. is you spent 20 plus years in CorpFin and you were responsible for this part of the filing process. And I know you dealt a lot with the 305 financial statements, and there's this waiver process mm-hmm. where even if you do trip one of these buckets, as you put it, that would trigger having to file these, you know, financials of the target, you can go to CorpFin and ask for a waiver. Now you need to have a legitimate reason to do that, mm-hmm. but I wanted you to walk us through how that waiver process works, given you used to approve these requests.
I think you're teeing up another number. So under Rule 313, that does give the staff authority to permit omissions or substitutions of specific financial statements required under Reg SX. So the process involves sending a formal waiver request to the staff in CorpFin's Office of Chief Accountant.
And this is a letter, right? Like a formal...
It is.
Written letter.
Formal written letter.
Okay, mm-hmm. So let's talk about what makes for a good letter.
You did use the word legitimate Yes, it has to have a legitimate reason for needing a waiver or substitution. So a good letter, I would say, lays out all the facts, the specific relief that the company is seeking, and the legal and factual analysis for why a waiver or substitution would be appropriate. I also think it's a good practice to propose an alternative. And what I mean by that is if, for example, you're asking for a full waiver of 2 years of financial statements, maybe asking for 1 year if that's possible, or a substitution of maybe abbreviated financial statements may be a good alternative that the staff would be willing to entertain.
Okay, so even if you go in with a waiver, having some kind of negotiating, hey, can't you do the full, but maybe we can give you the one that gives you a starting point.
Yeah.
And I know the staff has talked about this over the years at the AACPA conference. And, you know, some of the things they've mentioned are what led to the transaction. You know, was it a merger? What was some kind of reorg of the business before? What's the structure? What's being acquired? Is it mostly intangible? So there's a lot that goes into this letter.
Yeah.
And so probably the more information you can provide up front, the better. But maybe more importantly than the letter itself is the process and how you go about navigating and dealing with the staff. So same question to you. What makes for a good process if you're the one going in?
I think starting off with just making sure it's a timely request and you're not waiting up against a deadline, like, oh, wait, I'm at day 69 and I have to file these financial statements, you know, or if you're pre-IPO and you want to file your registration statement and you realize last minute you have these 305s that you can't get a hold of, I think it's important to just sort of think ahead. But also the process can be very collaborative with the staff. In fact, I would say typically after a letter is submitted, you'll receive a call from the staff, usually asking more questions or making sure they understand the fact pattern. If you don't receive a call, you can always pick up the phone and call them, making sure the letter is in the right hand. Sometimes with that system, it can get routed to different offices. So you just want to make sure that, you know, they have it in hand. But it is very collaborative, and it's a pretty streamlined process.
So, is it a best practice that once you send it in, just a light follow up confirming that they got it and offering up a phone call, for example?
Yes, I would say light follow up.
You don't want to hound them.
Exactly.
But just making sure it went to the right place, like you said.
Exactly.
All right, this is good setup because now I want to get into the specifics of, you know, what makes for a good, or maybe to use the words we were using earlier, a legitimate reason. You know, what makes for a good case as to why the staff, you know, may consider granting one of these waiver requests. So I want to just play a little game called Build a Case. You want to do it?
Let's do it.
All right. So I'm going to start with, I think what we hear in every single one of these instances, which is some version of it's really hard or it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll start with one version of it, which is we bought a carve out of a larger entity. It's a deeply integrated product line, hasn't prepared separate financial statements. It's going to be really complicated and messy to go get audited financials for that carve out business. How am I doing? Is that going to fly?
No, I'm going to be the heavy hand right now. No, you've only stated a fact. You haven't even asked me a question. You haven't even made an argument. No, the staff hear this all the time, actually, and on its own, it's not a very strong opening or start. They see navigating these issues as a cost of doing business. So, and they're really not going to feel sorry for you and give you a hardship waiver. So you're going to need more.
Yeah. So back to your point, if you're buying a carve out, this needs to be baked into the process early on because, you know, if it's significant, that reason alone, at least, isn't going to get you this waiver. Right. Let me try a different angle. Let's say I bought a portfolio company from a private equity firm. It's never had an audit. It never even did push down accounting from when it was acquired by the PE firm. So going back in time, trying to recreate those financial statements and roll it forward is going to be a nightmare. Mm. Does that change your mind at all?
Nightmare sounds like a hardship again. Try again.
All right. So the it's hard isn't going to get it done. All right. Fair enough. I hear you. Let's add another layer. So not only is it hard or expensive, but now I'm going to layer in the it barely failed argument. So you said there's three tests. Mm-hmm. We picked the highest one and that determines what bucket we're in. But let's just say I only failed one of those three tests. And in fact, when I look at the other two, I wasn't even close to being significant. Let's say I was below 5%, for example.
Is that something that weighs in the staff?
You're building a case now. So I think that's an important piece of information. I think presenting all of the calculations, and so that is also a practice point too. Like a good letter will include all of the tests. Otherwise, the staff will just ask for them.
Yep.
But showing all the calculations and maybe only having one that trips the significance tells me that maybe this isn't a significant acquisition and that the rules might be creating an anomalous result. So, and that is a concept that they are open to.
Okay. So if you only failed one and the other ones were, there was a big gap between the percentages on the one you failed versus the two that you didn't, you've at least got a potential opening here.
Mm-hmm.
But let's try to take it one step further. You know, not only did I only fail one of the three, but I can explain why I failed that and why it, like you said, is anomalous or maybe not that meaningful when I'm thinking about the purpose of this, you know, regulation. So I'll just throw out an example. You know, the only reason I failed was the investment test. And I only tripped that because my shares aren't trading yet. And I'm, you know, preparing for this S1. So I had to use my total assets as the denominator for the investment test. Whereas if I could look at my market cap, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I wouldn't have failed. Or another one I think that we've seen before, again, failed the investment test because there's a massive amount of contingent consideration in this deal that I had to fair value, but it's tied to milestones that are years away and far from being certain. And so if you strip those out, I wouldn't have failed the test. Does explaining the why behind you fail?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's so much better. And you're proving, you know, why the result isn't reflective of the economic substance. And it just sounds like a more comprehensive analysis that they will appreciate.
Okay. Let me throw one more on.
Okay.
I don't want to call it the final layer because I feel like you could just keep peeling back the onion mm-hmm. on this thing. And you've seen a million, you know, flavors of this. But, you know, the it's not meaningful argument, even if these historical financial statements were provided for the 1 year or 2 years or whatever it might be, it's just not going to be material to my investors. I guess the example that I'm thinking of here is, let's say I acquire a business. Mm-hmm. So I'm in this, you know, regulation in the first place. But most of the value, if not all the value of that business, was tied to IP that wasn't on the books of the target, you know, is internally generated. Mm-hmm. But I paid for it because that's the value and I expect it to be very profitable for me going forward. So I failed the investment test because I paid a lot for this thing. But when you look at its historical operations, you know, maybe it's just R&D or the minimal activity, and compared to my historical operations, it's pretty small. So I don't think it's meaningful to my investors. What do you think of that?
I think that's good. I think you've shown that the acquisition is not significant. It's based on an anomalous test and would ultimately not be meaningful to investors. So I feel like you are building a compelling case that the staff may agree to.
Actually. All right. Mm-hmm. Maybe I've done this once or twice.
Maybe.
But like, I think the key takeaway is you really need multiple, like a combination of those things, probably even some other factors too, depending on your facts and circumstances. I'm not sure any one of those on their own
correct
would get you there. Would
exactly.
you agree?
I would agree.
Mm-hmm. But if you can start to explain the why and the business purpose and all that, and how an investor might think about it, it's backed up by the facts, then you know you got a shot. All right. So at this point, we've been talking about all of this in the context of the Form 8K. Mm-hmm. And really that when I'm referring to that, I'm talking about that timeline we laid out. So you got 4 days after the acquisition's consummated to file that initial 8K. Then you've got this 71-day grace period to include these 305 financials that we've really been spending a lot of time on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some things that can throw a wrench into that timeline. And registration statements are the big one that comes to mind for me because mm-hmm. it's a much different ballgame when you're, you know, dealing with a registration statement. And so I wanted to talk about some of the traps that I think companies fall into because of the interaction between filing a registration statement with that 8K timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's the first trap is the timeline itself because the registration statement can really accelerate that 71-day clock of having to include those 305 financials. So maybe just talk about that dynamic.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. So, and especially for very significant acquisitions. And so what I mean by that is if the acquisition was recently consummated, so to your point, less than within that 75 days, the requirement to file 305 financial statements depends on significance. So if a company consummates an acquisition that was more than 50% significant, the acquiree financial statements must be included in that registration statement, even if it is before they would otherwise be due in that 8K amendment.
Okay.
If significance is less than 50%, the acquiree financial statements can be excluded unless they've already been filed.
So it's interesting. We're introducing a new threshold for significance, because when we talked about this in the context of the 8K, mm-hmm. 40% was the highest we went in terms of the bucket. That was like the most significant.
Yep. Yep.
But in this case, in a registration statement, we're really looking for something that's greater than 50% on one of those three tests that we talked about.
Yeah. And actually, the other thing I wanted to add too is, you know, I was just talking about within that window, because I know your point is accelerating that deadline. But also, you know, for registration statements for business acquisitions that were consummated 75 days or more before registration statements filed or declared effective, the financial statements of that acquiree are required unless the operating results have been reflected in the acquirer's financial statements for 9 or 12 months. So just wanted to make that point.
Yeah. So in that case, let's just assume they haven't been included in the financials. You presumably have already filed an 8K. You can incorporate that by reference into the registration statement.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So let me give an example, because I really think the point I want to hammer home is that 71-day clock could evaporate if you do a registration statement. And going back to your point on just the importance of planning ahead, especially if you're doing a big deal, this is something you got to be aware of, because if you plan on filing this registration statement before the 71-day clock, you better make sure you have those 305s ready to go. So here's my example. I buy a company on January 1st. We'll just keep it simple, first day of the year. Mm-hmm. It's more than 50% significant. So I'm going to file that initial 8K on January 5th.
Yeah, you're 201.
My item 201 on Form 8K.
Correct.
I'm going to take the full 4 days that you said I've got. January 5th, I file that. At that point, I've still got 71 days to file the 305 financials. But then I go out and do a registration statement on February 22nd. Which happens to be my wife's birthday. You're telling me. Yeah, shameless plug. Exactly. It's an important date, came to mind. So you're telling me those 305s, I would need to include in that registration statement on February 22nd.
Yes, that's exactly right. So because the registration statement was filed within that 75 days and the acquisition was significant over 50%, those financial statements need to be filed. And you no longer have that 71-day grace period.
Okay. And is this any registration statement?
Well, yes, except for S4s always, they can get complicated. And so that's probably a whole nother podcast that you can do that I...
Are you signing up for that?
No, I'm not. All
right. We'll see. Maybe we'll have to dive into that. That gets into the real nitty gritty. But okay, I think a common one, and we talked about this last time you were on, is an S1, right? So if you're going to go public, you've got to think about the 305 timeline in that registration statement. But it's not limited to just S1s. So, all right, let's talk about, I think, another trap that, you know, companies may fall into. And that's, we've talked about a lot of what's required once you've closed on an acquisition. Mm-hmm. You've actually consummated the transaction. But registration statements might actually make you file 305s for the target, even if the acquisition isn't closed yet, which is interesting. So can you talk about that dynamic?
Yeah. So I would say your trap two is the probable acquisition.
Yep.
So 8K rules only apply to acquisitions you've consummated.
Yep.
But in a registration statement, you have to also look at your probable acquisitions. And so if you have an acquisition that's deemed probable and it's over 50%, you must include those historical financial statements in the registration statement, even though it hasn't been consummated.
All right, you're going to love this next question.
Yeah, I'm scared.
How do you define probable?
Well, okay, so that's a great point. I will say comment letters may comment and ask companies how they consider probability, but I will say that I don't think if you were to pre-clear something like that or in your 305 analysis, I don't think you're going to get an answer by this CFOCA staff on that. I don't think they typically weigh in on probable. But with that being said, the rule doesn't define probable, but the staff may look at various factors to assess probability, including whether a public announcement has been made. They look at progress of negotiations, whether or not you maybe have a letter of intent that's been signed, even if it's non-binding. You know, whether you've conducted due diligence and where you are in that process. Economic and legal penalties for maybe not closing the deal is something else they might look at.
And finally, I guess, you know, are there significant regulatory burdens or hurdles actually that you might need to clear, like antitrust reviews, jurisdictional issues that might not be considered probable until those are resolved? So various things that they look at.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that I love analogies. And I did a podcast a while back on significant influence. And in my intro to that podcast, I listed my Mount Rushmore of most ambiguously defined terms in GAAP, and probable was on the list. So I guess it's not just funny. GAAP, it's SEC regulations as well, because I mean, to your point, it's not one thing. There's no strict definition, but usually it's a combination of factors that you've got to think about in terms of whether you've crossed that line. And then I think another trap door, so to speak, if we keep going with that analogy, that I wanted to talk about, we've talked a lot about 305s in the context of a significant acquisition, right? Something's over that, at least that 20% threshold. Let's say you've done an acquisition that doesn't meet the 20% threshold. You know, are you good? Are you done at that point? Or are there more things to think about if you're that company?
So that's a great question. And there is a lot of legs to this 305 rule, to be honest with you. I mean, this is one of them. So you can't just look at these deals in isolation. A couple things come to mind when a company does an insignificant acquisition and it has either done other insignificant deals or it plans to. So the first is whether any of those other insignificant acquisitions were related.
And what does that mean?
Well, before I get into that, I'll say if they are related, they must be treated as a single business acquisition when testing significance.
Okay.
And so that also includes probable acquisitions too. So if they exceed 20% significance together, you have an 8K filing requirement for all of them. And so you ask what makes them related.
Wait, hold on a second. Okay. You're saying if they're related, I look at them as if I acquired a single business.
Yes.
Right. And then if that combined exceeds the 20%, you're filing 305s for the combination of the two or each one individually?
Each one individually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. Sorry. Yeah. Now my question, what makes somebody, well, not somebody, what makes two companies related?
Yeah. So acquisitions are related if there's common control or common management of the acquired business or when their acquisition is conditioned on a single common event, such as like an offering or an acquisition of another business, they would be considered related.
Got it. Okay. That one's a little more clear than the probable discussion.
Yes.
And then you mentioned, I think that there were two things that came to mind when I asked about, you know, insignificant acquisitions. So I'm guessing the second one applies even to unrelated businesses.
Yes. Yes. So even if you have multiple unrelated acquisitions, the rules for registration statements still require you to aggregate all individually insignificant acquisitions that you've made since your last audited balance sheet date. And this includes consummated acquisitions that exceed 20%, but not 50%, and whose financials have yet to be filed, and any acquisitions since the latest fiscal year that don't exceed 20%. Plus, you still have to think about probable acquisitions that did not exceed 50% significance when you're doing your aggregation tests. So that goes back to what we were just talking about. And if that group taken together crosses the 50% threshold, then you have a filing requirement. So this is a lot of buckets.
That's a lot to think about. I mean, in the simple example, I did four acquisitions during the year. You know, they're all at the 15% mark. So all individually insignificant. Yep. Let's just say they're unrelated. So I never filed an 8K. But now I do a registration statement. And because you're saying those deals, when you add them up or greater than 50%, I've got to file something in that registration statement. What am I filing? What am I putting in there?
Yeah. So if the group exceeds 50%, you're required to provide audited financial statements for any of the individual acquisitions that were over 20% significance, if you haven't filed them already. And then you'd also need to provide pro forma financial information depicting the aggregate impact of all of those acquisitions.
Okay. And you said I also need to include probable acquisitions in that aggregation. What if there's a probable acquisition that's over 20, less than 50? Am I putting those separate financials in?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of moving parts here.
I know. We need flow charts. You should get into that. Move from analogies to flow charts.
All right. I'll give that a shot. So let me go back to my example. Because I said I never filed an 8K, right? Because I wasn't required to.
Correct.
None of them were individually significant. But if someone expects to be in this situation we're talking about, they know they're going to do multiple acquisitions, or they, you know, they expect to. Is there any wisdom to voluntarily filing an 8K?
Oh, there could be. There could be. I mean, that would be a good strategy to use. I'm following filing voluntarily would get that information on file. And it would allow a company to incorporate them into the registration statement. And that could save a lot of time and hassle and eliminate all of those calculations that we just talked about.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, not to beat a dead horse, but thinking ahead, planning, making sure you're on top of this so you don't get caught by surprise. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be scrambling, trying to pull together audited financial statements of the target, which could hold up your registration statement. All right, this is great. I think I've got a good handle on the 305 requirements and all the different rules that you mentioned.
Test?
Don't quiz me at the end. We'll save that for the CPE listeners. But all right, let me just ask, I'll get you out of here on this question. What's one thing that you think a CFO should take away from this entire conversation?
Other than all of the citations and references that I've provided, I would say not to get lost in the details of the rules. They are so complicated. There's so much to them. So although they are very important, I would say just to not forget your primary audience is the investor, and to focus on what information a reasonable investor would actually need to understand, you know, the company going forward. And, you know, as I mentioned before, we have a lot of resources out there. Well, you mentioned that KPMG has a lot of resources out there. And I mentioned earlier, the FRM has been recently updated for these new rules. And I would also just encourage companies, if they have questions, they can always pick up the phone and call the staff too.
And this seems like a perfect area to phone home.
Yep.
Whether it's a staff, advisor, friend, you know, this is one where you might want a second opinion given the complexity.
Yes.
All right, Melissa, thank you so much for coming on.
Sure.
Looking forward to doing the S4 podcast.
Sure thing.
A huge thanks to Melissa Rocha for coming back on the pod and sharing her love of the rules and regulations of the SEC with us and her wisdom from her time there. It was extremely valuable. Now, whether you just finished the full episode and want the quick recap, or you're just tuning in to the bottom line for the highlights, allow me to summarize what my key takeaways were. Number one, once the deal closes, the SEC filing window opens. If you do an acquisition that's significant, meaning it crosses that 20% threshold on either the investment, asset, or income tests, then the target's historical financial statements, which we call the 305s, must be filed on Form 8K with the SEC. The level of significance dictates how much work is ahead. If the target's over 20%, you need 1 year of financials. If it's over 40%, you need 2 years of financials. And you get 4 business days to file that initial 8K after the acquisition closes. And then there's another 71-day grace period to get those 305s on file. This could be a tight turnaround depending on the situation, which leads me to my second takeaway, the waiver process. This is a highly valuable resource, but you need to have a good strategy. I thought this was a huge insight for Melissa, especially because when she was at the SEC, she was the one granting some of these requests. And basically, if you do a significant acquisition, you can go to the SEC and ask them for a waiver to not file the 305s. And we see this a lot when it comes to carve-outs and other situations where the target doesn't have clean financials. However, simply arguing that it's going to be very difficult or very expensive to get those financials is simply a non-starter, no matter how persuasive you think the argument is. Instead, the key is to build a comprehensive case. You need to show why the rules are creating an anomalous result, prove that the required financial statements wouldn't actually be meaningful to an investor, and ideally propose an alternative to the staff. And my final takeaway, registration statements are the ultimate trapdoor for an acquirer. We actually talked about 3 trapdoors that registrations create for acquisitions. Number one, it could seriously accelerate the deadline to file those 305s, especially if the registration statement's filed or declared effective during that 71-day grace period that I mentioned. Second, it brings into scope probable acquisitions. So while an 8K only applies to consummated transactions, a registration statement may require 305s, even if the transaction hasn't closed yet. And then lastly, if you do a series of individually insignificant deals, but when you add them all up, they cross the significance threshold, then you're going to have to include at least some information about those in the registration statement. All of this leads to what's probably the biggest takeaway of all, which is that the accounting and finance teams simply have to be plugged into the M&A strategy from the beginning so you don't get caught scrambling at the end. I'm Nick Tricarci, and this has been The Bottom Line. If you want to dive deeper into these rules, I highly recommend checking out our SEC Considerations for Business Combinations handbook. You can find it on our FRV website. It's packed full of examples and Q&As and interpretations of what rules apply in what situations. And as always, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a review and reach out to us if there's topics you want us to tackle in the future. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you later.